With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Buddy, welcome to Red Shirts and Runabouts. This is episode 29. I am Derek, filling in as the lead host for Greg, who could not join us this evening. And I've got my buddy Jeremy with me.
Hello, hello.
Welcome back, man. It's just the two of us tonight.
Just the two of us.
You know, I've been listening to Will Smith all day, actually, in my free time. It's true. Anyway, so we don't really have any news, so we're just going to dive right into the main topics, which are discussions on the two original series episodes from season one, Mudd's Women and Balance of Terror. And if you're wondering why those two episodes, because you're just tuning in, we have decided to try an interesting format where we will review the top four rated and the bottom four rated episodes from the same season of Star Trek, the original series, and pair up one good with one bad. And the ratings are based off of IMDb.
So is this the top, like the number two episode and then the number two from the bottom episode? Is that how this works?
Correct. Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So we have Mudd's Women, which is actually the third episode of the series to air. And then we have Balance of Terror, which is later, episode 8. So yeah, I guess we'll start with Mudd's Women, because we're going to do the bad episode first and then the good episode.
The first, I would like to share my very strange experience with Balance of Terror, not going into the plot of the episode, but just how I watched it.
Please.
In that I watched, and I was into it, but I was so drained from watching Mudd's Women that I was like on the edge of consciousness. And at the about 50% mark, I totally passed out, but it was on Netflix and autoplaying to the next episode. So I, from looking back at what I saw, I woke up about an hour later, it was still playing, and I thought I was only out for a second, so I just kept watching. But it was the next episode, and then I was just like having such a hard time following what was happening. I fell asleep again and then woke back up and it was another episode, but I was now so groggy at this point that I was just like, okay, I got to get to the end of this episode, and just nothing made sense and I had no idea what was happening. And I think the second episode I watched was Shore Leave, and I forgot what the third one was, but then I looked at the time and it was like 4 hours after I had started watching Star Trek, and I was like, God damn it. And I just like got frustrated and went to bed and finished it this morning.
Wow, man, that is an ordeal.
Yeah, it was a really confusing, I was like, this is so complicated. I have these like new characters have shown up and I don't know where anyone is. But no, it's just those two ships in that episode. There's no new planets, no new characters.
So I guess you're lucky that you didn't end up waking up in the middle of an episode where Mark Leonard was playing Sarek and you had him playing just two completely different roles. That would have been fun.
Yeah, and we'll get into that when we get there. I was like, oh man, it's the same guy who plays this character later on, and then I was like, wait, no, he plays Sarek. That's Spock's dad.
Yes, yeah. We'll get to the details on Balance of Terror. That's a fun story, man. I hate autoplay on things like Netflix and all that. So there's a prime example of why I just want to tell it when I'm ready to watch the next episode.
I usually like it until it shames me with the, are you still watching Arrested Development? I'm like, yeah, Netflix, I am. Don't leave me alone. Play the next episode. Stop judging me.
Fair enough.
Anyway, Mudd's Women.
Mudd's Women. So a bit confused. So, you know, the original series, of course, was produced and aired and released in weird orders and things like that. So I apologize if my numbers are not lining up here. I guess this was the sixth episode actually released of the original series, but it's also called episode 1X03. So very confusing. But yeah, Mudd's Women.
Who cares?
Yeah, as some people do. It actually might be one of my least favorite episodes of Star Trek.
It was very much to me like, what was the other bad one that we watched last week?
Oh, the the alternative factor.
Was that the one with the two guys from parallel dimensions and dark matter and stuff?
Yes.
Yeah. The problem with Mudd's Women, aside from Mudd just being an evil person, is that you just get the trick like right away, and then you're just like exhaustingly waiting for it to end, because you know within the first minutes that like this guy's a con man, these women are like his sex slaves, and you just know what's going to happen, and it's boring because the whole time you're just like, all right, get it over with.
Yeah, I think that's fair. People get really obsessed with Harry Mudd, and you know, a lot of people wanted him to be the antagonist in Star Trek Into Darkness when people were being told it was not Khan. And of course, he was cast and played by Rainn Wilson in Star Trek Discovery. I've never been interested in Harry Mudd until Rainn Wilson's portrayal in Discovery. He finally made the character compelling for me. Not that I had any problem with the original actor, it's just, he's cheesy, he's over the top, he just doesn't really seem likable, he's sleazy, and he doesn't really seem competent.
Yeah, like, he's not charming enough to root for, and he's not a lovable rogue, he's more just kind of a dirtbag, who the show clearly wants you to believe is a lovable rogue. Because, like, there's that one Next Generation episode where there's the guy that shows up that's some, like, freewheeling merchant, and he's got a very, like, you know, Robin Hood vibe, and it's, like, a very interesting character, and the crimes that he commits that he's trying to keep under wraps are minimal enough that it's like, oh, you scamp, I kind of root for you still. But Harry Mudd's a human trafficker that gets women addicted to drugs. It's like, Jesus Christ, this guy's a scum of the earth.
Or whatever. Yeah, more or less. From. Yeah. And I don't think you've seen his later episodes.
Nope.
I think this is as good as it gets for him. If that's helpful.
Wait, there's a worse Harry Mudd original series episode?
I'm not sure if the episode itself is worse, but he's just worse. Right,
really?
Like,
I'm surprised. I assume the Rainn Wilson portrayal was based off of who he was in these episodes, and I mean, the Rainn Wilson's character in Discovery was a murderer and a sociopath, but he was like fun. I don't know.
That's the thing. So, you know, I don't know Rainn Wilson's process. I can't speak to that, but if he got inspiration from the original Harry Mudd, it couldn't have been very much, because Rainn Wilson's version of the character is drastically different. And like I said, the first time I've really cared for the character at all, the Harry Mudd in the original series, maybe it's because it's the 60s, is just too campy for me. He's too over the top. He's too just not believable that he could pull this stuff off.
Yeah.
You know, versus in Discovery, where you've got, you know, he's doing time travel and he's killing people and he's sarcastic about it, you know, and starts going a little crazy at times. I mean, he
had that cool helmet.
The Andorian helmet. Yeah, that was cool. Yeah. You know, but when he's in the Klingon prison ship, you know, he'll do anything it takes to survive. He's ruthless, but he's very intelligent. Whereas the one in the original series, especially here in Mudd's Women, is, yeah, he's more like an infomercial salesman. No offense to anybody out there who is an infomercial salesman, but it doesn't come off as like a great villain. It just comes off as like he's a salesman.
Yeah.
right? He's selling a product, which in this case are the women, right? And there's a little bit of trickery about it because they take these pills that make them seem more attractive than they really are, quote unquote. And that's the whole thing. That's the con. It's not like it's, you know, Ocean's 11 out here or something like that.
Well, and that, I mean, they're supposed to be perfectly beautiful women, and they're good looking and everything, but they portray them almost like the Orion women with like the pheromone powers or something. Like in the fiction of this episode, they're just supposed to be very sexy, but whenever Bones is looking at him, they like put Vaseline on the camera and like play twinkly noises like he's being hypnotized. It's like, well, they're not the, you know, it's like, calm down.
Well, I think that's supposed to do with the Venus pill that they're taking is supposed to have some type of effect. I mean, I don't know. It's a little confusing, right? And it's a one of the cinematography issues with the original series is that, you know, if someone is supposed to appear extra attractive, then they've got, you know, the softer lens with the lights and the glowing and the sparkle and, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so they all get that quite a bit. And you're right. The men just can't seem to keep their heads on straight.
And then they seem to negate. I mean, they do indicate that there's some additional effect of this like Venus drug when it starts making Bones's instruments. I mean, we know his instrument is going haywire, but when it makes his computer instruments go haywire.
Zing.
Zing. Zing-a-ding. But then at the end, they give them fake ones and they turn beautiful, seemingly negating, like they made it seem like all of the Venus drug was a placebo at the end of the episode.
Yeah, so that's always bothered me because it seems like they decided at the end of the episode that they were going to have a lesson to teach everybody, like a after school show. And the lesson is that, you know, you're really as beautiful as you believe you are. And, you know, that kind of self-confidence and a good self-image kind of thing is more powerful than the drug is, I think, is the message they're trying to put across. But then it does lead the question of, well, does the drug ever work anyway? Or was that also a con?
Yeah. Yeah. It's just, the one kind of narrative they were building, they just negate the reality of, and then it, you look back and it's like, well, then what was happening to all of these people? It's like, what, clearly they were addicted to it because it ran out after a certain time. So it's not like the drug gave them the confidence to be supernaturally beautiful. It was doing something. And then like she, I mean, it's one thing to think like she got placeboed effect and was more confident about herself, but you know, her skin cleared up and her clothes got tighter and she got makeup. And it's like, that's not, you don't get placebo new dress. It's just like, I don't know. It just doesn't make sense.
Yeah. It's a little on the nose. 'Cause you're right. There are physical changes to these women, but it's supposed to be that, you know, they now have confidence in themselves, right? And that it, the pill never really did anything. It was really just how they felt.
Yeah. It is funny, though, like, looking back on 60s beauty standards, that it's like, these are okay-looking women, but it's not like I would look at any of these three women and go like, wow, this is the most beautiful woman I've ever seen. It's like, oh, she looks like a seven. It's like, and not to be rude or anything, but it's just like, I don't know. There's something interesting because they just look like, they look like a younger version of somebody's mom. I think it's just with like the hair and the general aesthetic of the time. It's just like, it's so strange to see how that whole thing has changed. But it's same with all of the male characters on the show. It's like nobody would ever buy any of these guys as male leads on a TV show anymore because they just all look like, you know, someone's uncle. It's like everyone on 60s TV looked like someone's aunt or uncle from the 90s.
Well, don't forget these women were also, you know, supposed to be meeting these minors who haven't seen a woman in a couple of years, right? And so at that point, I think, you know, they just want to have somebody.
Yeah.
And, you know, that helps a little bit.
So they're lithium crystals powered ships in the original series, and then for Next Generation it's dilithium?
Okay. Dilithium is used on the original Enterprise later, especially in the movies. That's a thing. It's a little unclear when the switch happens. But yeah, I think part of the idea is that the dilithium crystals, they have these chambers that allow it to regenerate itself. And I think the lithium crystals were more limited or something like that. I can't quite remember the details, but it may have been as simple as they just started using a different name.
Yeah, it was interesting this episode that the stakes were just like, the ship's running out of batteries. We have to do something about it. It's like... That just feels like such a it's in all other Trek instances, you never have this kind of like, we're running out of batteries and we're dead in the water if we don't get some new batteries. And it's like, oh, that seems like such a, I don't know, mundane. It's like the Enterprise ran out of gas. Let's hit a gas station.
It happens. I mean, it's definitely a thing that happens on Voyager. Time to time, since they're lost in the Delta Quadrant, right? So they have to get resources, and so they yeah. shut down power to certain, you know, decks and parts of the ship and things like that, which was cool. I liked thinking that there were some limitations, that we haven't figured everything out. But
never see that on DS9 though, where it's like
DS9. The station's in shambles when the series starts, and O'Brien really has to put it completely back together.
Yeah, that's true. There are a lot of system flickers, but it's like at a core, fuel or energy, it never seemed like the issue was the DS9 is out of gas and we need more
that's true.
Space station batteries.
That's a good point. But it's not traveling at warp or anything either.
That's true.
You know, I don't know. I'm not an expert in space station engineering, so. Yeah. It's kind of a lackluster episode though, Mud's Women. It's a very basic story, like we've said. There's not a whole lot else that goes into it. At the end of the day, the women are happy, the men are happy, and Mud still kind of gets the short end of the stick, which is a little weird because if everybody ends up happy and everyone's doing what they want to do, then when it's all said and done, what did he do? Did he do anything wrong or did he not do anything wrong? Like, it was always unclear to me if he was like really selling these women or if it was more of a mutual relationship where they were looking for men and he was, you know, the middleman.
Oof. I mean, that seems pretty generous. I mean, at the end of the day, he forced Kirk into a position where he was sex trafficking for lithium crystals. I mean, he got the crystals and the miners got a woman, and that was very transactional, and they all seemed to be kind of like okay with it. I don't know.
That's the problem, right? Because everybody seems okay with it at the end. It feels weird because it takes away at least some of the negative connotation of what the episode starts out as. Because at the beginning, you're supposed to feel like, well, Mud's just trying to sell these women to strangers on a planet. Like, that's really messed up. And all that matters is their physical appearance. And so that's really shallow. And at the end of the episode, you find, you know, the message is, well, the beauty is really the confidence from within. And the women and the men are happy because they get to have a companion now. And, you know, so, like, there's a happy ending. So it's a very confusing feeling.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, that we see the two a little more the little more down to clown women just like start rubbing all over those miners, and then the one who's questions, the more like skeptical one, when she actually is addressed with the realities of living on this planet, that like she's trapped in this bunker for most of the time. And as soon as you step outside, you're as good as dead and all this stuff. And it's like, we never really resolve that concern for her. Like she regains the confidence in herself, which, you know, Gold Star, that's nice and everything, but she's still trapped on a planet with these garbage guys that are fighting over women, and it's not like he fell in love with her. She's a piece of property that fell in his lap and he traded crystals for. So it's like they're okay with it for now, but mm-hmm. like tomorrow she still has to deal with this reality that she's marooned on a planet with someone who sees her as a sex object. It's just like gross.
Basically, yeah. I mean, the men, I think, want a little more than that. You know, they're looking for someone to take care of them and be a companion as well. But it is a very shallow relationship. It's definitely very old way of thinking, right?
I mean, it's old way of thinking, but also he got mad when she started to cook for him. That was a weird twist.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was weird.
It's like, hey, I only cook for me. And it's like, well, what's happening?
Yeah, that was strange. Like,
are you being chivalrous or are you being guarded? I mean, the point they were trying to push with that moment was just like he's not used to having someone else, and she's expecting this very specific lifestyle that she's clearly not going to get.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't know. There was just like everything was muddy.
Yeah. Well, so some interesting factual information about the episode. So Harry Mudd only shows up in 3 episodes, 2 in the original series and 1 in the animated series. So even though he's widely considered to be like the recurring character of the original series, as far as like antagonists are concerned, he was really only on 2 legitimate episodes and 1 animated episode. So, you know, something to kind of keep in mind from that standpoint. This episode though, like it, hate it, love it, whatever, actually is an old episode. The script for this episode was pitched both times the show was up for a pilot. And they went with The Cage, of course, as the original pilot, and then Where No Man Has Gone Before. But this was around for both of those goes. And can you imagine if that had been the episode made for one of the pilots?
I can barely imagine the episode was made as an episode.
So yeah, so this is an old one. This is one of Gene Roddenberry's original scripts.
Yeah, and you can kind of tell that it's there's one trick to it. The whole narrative, it's just like Mudd's got a secret, and then the whole episode is just finding out what the secret is, and it just like takes forever. It's very boring.
Yeah, it's a little lackluster. Certainly not one of the more exciting episodes. Yeah, I mean, that's all I have for this one. It's boring, yeah. It's Mudd, so it's somewhat iconic because Mudd has become kind of a pop culture aspect of the show for whatever reason. But I'll take Rainn Wilson's interpretation any day.
Yeah. Yeah, at least he's got, like, kind of a motivation. Rainn Wilson was trying to save his own skin, and he was trying to hide from the woman whose father bought him a moon, but at the same time he was trying to get everything he wanted and all this stuff. So it's like he had clear motivation and he had a lot of ups and downs, whereas this portrayal of Mudd, he's just, you know, he's running a con and he gets his way in the grand scheme of things, which is just, I don't know, that's this aside from knowing what was going to happen from the beginning, just the lack of resolution to anything at the end where everyone just kind of shrugs and goes, I guess this is fine. And then they all move on with their lives. It's just like, well, what is the point of any of this? It's like, no one's really happy, but nobody's like dealing with anything. It's just over. Yeah. Let's talk about the other one.
Yeah, no, that's fine. As a small note, though, since I know that you're new to the original series, so Harry Mudd's wife, the woman from the Discovery episode whose father, you know, bought the moon and all that, she does return in Harry Mudd's second episode, I, Mudd, in season 2 of the original series. And so the Discovery episode really had some nice moments to tie into that.
Mm. But the Discovery took place before that, so that was kind of a prequel.
Right, that's cool. Exactly. Yep.
It'll be interesting to see.
Stella.
Because I'm actually watching them in chronological order.
Yeah, it's a little different in your case. But all right, so next, The Balance of Terror. So the 14th episode released out of all 744. The Memory Alpha tagline for this one really just summarizes it really very well. The Enterprise battles a Romulan ship suspected of destroying outposts near the neutral zone. And that's the episode.
Yeah, this episode kind of blew my mind.
Okay.
Because I had never thought about Romulan cloaking technology in the context of submarines, which was clearly the parallel they were drawing with this episode. This was totally a normal ship battling a submarine. And to see it contextualized that way, like, I just never thought about it that way. Whereas this is such, like, a perfect, like, Hunt for Red October type story.
Hmm.
And it's like they're firing their torpedoes and using them like depth charges. And they're, when they go into cloak, they're much more vulnerable than we see them later with cloaking technology. And that, like, we know you always have to have your shields down to go into cloak, but in this, it seems like when they were cloaked, they were just, they could only move. They couldn't fire or aim or anything.
Yeah, it really set the tone for what ended up, you know, being in the movies, The Undiscovered Country, with the Klingons and things like that. I mean, this episode laid the groundwork for what cloaking technology really was going to be in the Star Trek universe. You had to have your shields down while you were cloaked. You could not fire while cloaked. That was the unique thing about Kang's ship in The Undiscovered Country, is a bird of prey that could fire while cloaked. They weren't supposed to be able to do that. Yeah. And so the naval aspects, I guess, weren't strange for me, just because I always kind of looked at the original series as that kind of naval aspect. You look at the Wrath of Khan, for example, in the Mutara Nebula, it's very naval. It's very ship to ship kind of stuff. There's no, like, you know, fighters or quick maneuvers like there are in say the Dominion War or anything.
Yeah. And
like
I always thought of it of a lot of this stuff in a naval context, but I never thought about cloaking as submarine. Like, this, because I've only ever seen cloaking technology in a very agile, like, you pop up and you take a shot, and you pop up and you take a shot, and all that stuff, but never, like, we're going under, and now there's this tense moment that we know that we're surrounded by a ship, but it can't do anything until we can see it, and it's like, all of those moments where the camera pans in on Kirk, and it's got the intense lighting over his eyes, they did that so many times, and it's like, it's a little bit corny, but it's also like kind of badass, where it's just the one strip of light over Kirk's eyes.
Yeah. I like that they kind of handle it like a submarine. My problem is the way the Enterprise can track the ship. It knows the ship is moving, it knows the course that it's headed on, but it still can't pinpoint where the ship is while it's cloaked. And later, it's almost impossible for the Enterprise to ever find a cloaked vessel.
Yeah.
You know, so there's a little bit of inconsistencies there.
Well, maybe. And then there's the big inconsistency that the bird of prey has a literal bird of prey painted on it, which was kind of hilarious.
So, I mean, but that was a very Romulan thing. The original Romulan ships, that's how they looked. In fact, later there's some crossover between the Klingon and Romulan ships, because they sold each other ships.
Yeah,
the two empires. So that's why, you know, in TNG and Deep Space Nine, you've got the Romulan warbird and things of that nature. There are some bird aspects to it. The Romulan warbird that we see in the TNG era, it looks like it has a beak, and it looks like it has wings and things like that. So they kind of took the paint and made it more part of the design of the ship.
Well, yeah, it's just I had never seen this interpretation of that. So I've always seen, like, they have wings and they have, obviously have bird type, you know, qualities. But it was just like when they finally showed it and they just had like a painting of a bird on it, I was like, ah, this is what it looked like. It's just a bird.
See, it's so weird because, you know, I started with this show. This was how I began my Star Trek. So these designs, the Romulan warbird in this episode, the D7 Klingon battlecruiser, yeah, those are what I first picture when I think of those ships. And it's the TNG stuff that's kind of the later thought of, well, that's what they became. So it's kind of funny. So yeah, so we have this wedding at the beginning with two characters we do not know, and then we find out after things start going wrong, they both work in the phaser room.
Yeah.
Which is hilarious to me. So first, the phaser room itself is funny to me because they have Tactical on the bridge. So Tactical has to essentially be given an order by Kirk. Then Tactical presses a button that notifies the phaser room. And then the phaser room has to go across. Someone has to go across the room to actually fire the phasers.
Yeah, which kind of reduces the efficacy of everything that's happening on the bridge when you know they're just like... I mean, they're effectively project managers, in which, like, I recognize my own role in that, where it's like, oh, so they're not doing anything, they're just telling other people to do stuff.
I mean, a little bit, but, like, in the later shows, that makes certain sense in certain areas. Like, Geordi's the chief engineer, and he tells people to do stuff, right? But when Worf is pressing buttons at Tactical, he's firing phasers, he's firing torpedoes. So it's interesting that there's like this whole separate room just for phaser people. And there's like, you know, three or four people in there that are running the phasers.
Yeah. You know that they got phased out by automation in they a few did. Years.
Yeah. It's very true. But yeah, so we of course come back to the wedding later, but it's a weird way to start the episode because you're like, well, who are these people? You have no idea who these characters are.
I mean, we don't really come back to the wedding. The wedding doesn't happen.
Well, we come back to the room.
Oh, yeah, the chapel.
In the chapel, yeah. She's kind of sad, but she's, you know, she's tough. She's a Starfleet officer, and, you know.
Yeah, it's understood that these kind of things happen. But again, it refutes the mythology of the original series that red shirts are who dies, because he was yellow, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
yeah, it's definitely one of those tropes that doesn't really hold any water when you pay attention. You know, there's a lot of non-red shirts that die in Star Trek.
Well, and this was such a like notable moment that only one character died, and mm-hmm. It's like the way people talk about the original series, you'd think there would just be like armies and armies of red shirts dropping like flies, but it's, you know, not yet.
Mm-hmm. Now, I think my favorite part of this episode, well, maybe tied for favorite part of this episode, is how they handle Lieutenant Stiles.
Is that the guy that hates Spock?
He is the racist, yeah. So, yeah, this, of course, this episode came out in 1966. This is post-World War II. This is Cold War era. You have a lot of prejudices against people throughout the world because of the war and other reasons of just straight up racism. Yeah. And so again, Star Trek tackling a social issue, but, you know, putting it behind the veil of an alien. And Stiles doesn't like the way Spock looks. Spock looks like a Romulan, so he doesn't trust him anymore. It's a very racist thing. And this has one of, you know, the most famous lines in all of Star Trek, where Kirk tells him that, leave your prejudices in your quarters, there's no place for it on the bridge.
I
believe is how he says it, and that line is very important to me because it shows that that's not how he wants to run his ship. That's not who he is. He's gonna take an individual and he's gonna act on the individual, but as far as he's concerned, if you cannot follow orders and do your duty free of that type of prejudice, then get out.
Well, it's also the very like core underlying Roddenberry ethos of the show itself, of like, there's a black woman on the bridge and there's an Asian man on the bridge, and no one's ever going to draw attention to any of it because that's just how the future is when everyone's cool. And it's like, this guy's noteworthy because he's uncool. And it's like, all right, cool, let's make that the bad guy. But at the same time, it's got to be really unrewarding to be an unrepentant racist against a race that doesn't care. It's got to just be like, Spock, you suck. And he's like, I don't care. I don't care what you have to say. I am Spock. And it's like, shit.
Now, it is interesting that they even throw the lines in there to basically tie the Romulans to the Vulcans, which is used, you know, much later in Star Trek throughout the other shows, you know, unification in TNG and things of that matter, where we start to learn that the Vulcans were a very different people originally, and some of them did not want to embrace logic and lock away their emotions, and that's how we ended up with two very different species. And this is where it all began. It began in Balance of Terror right here.
Yeah, there should have been a moment where they see the commander of the Romulan ship on the view screen, and Spock just goes, "That looks exactly like my father."
Well, they didn't know that yet. Yeah. So, you know,
species are so much alike. My father is also Romulan.
But it is interesting, like, certain episodes early on become cornerstones for massive parts of the Star Trek mythology that get fleshed out. And this episode not only introduces the Romulan Empire for the first time, it introduces the cloak for the first time. It confirms the Romulan and Vulcan blood connection and their heritage for the first time. And shows what, you know, what the neutral zone is, and shows this Cold War aspect of, you know, there was a war 100 years ago and a lot of people died and we haven't spoken to each other since. We haven't seen each other since. You know, how do we handle that? Every move you make could lead to a war. And 100 years later, the Romulans and the Federation are still not that great with each other.
Well, yeah, and everything is that, like, that chess game of the back and forth of all of this stuff, and the tension and the quiet moments when they're waiting for them to surface. And like you really see all of the thinking on the enemy ship. And I feel like this, I mean, I've been watching these in sequence, so I don't know how often this happens, but you not only see the enemy captain, but you hear his logic and his reasoning, and you kind of get that, the narration of the both the hero and the villain being treated as protagonists in their own stories, which is really good storytelling just for anything. But like you see that context and everything for the Romulans, where they're like, it's like there is a sense to why we're doing what we're doing, and in our minds this is like what we have to do to survive. But then it, you know, it all ends up on that note of like, I wish we could have met under different circumstances. There's so much honor being exchanged back and forth. And it's like when Kirk makes a good move, like when captains of Enterprises make good moves against Klingons and stuff, you usually see the Klingons go, "Ah, these idiots," or like, "these animals." But here you see the enemy captain go like, "This Kirk is a genius. He can read minds." He's just like being so complimentary to Kirk as he's fighting him.
Yeah, I mean, this is a unique thing. The Romulans were shown to be very sophisticated, very even level-headed compared to the Klingons, of course. And in this particular instance, we're shown a commander who is supposed to be sympathetic, who's supposed to be flawed, and while he's an antagonist, he's not necessarily evil per se. And you can tell that the weight of his command is on his shoulders, much in the way it's weighed on Kirk and even Pike in the pilot. We know that he doesn't really want to do this anymore. He wants to go home. It's said multiple times he just wants to go home. And to know that he was beat by somebody who is worthy, a captain who's intelligent, who's experienced, who's creative, almost gave him an honorable death, yeah, in a way.
Yeah, and that's a big thing. I mean, this episode felt very familiar to me, because I feel like, you know, in addition to the Romulans as a species and the cloak and all the stuff that they kind of planted the seeds of as to what would grow into future Trek lore, there's also just the strong concepts of honor and of duty and of kind of the Cold War, I'm done with this and I need to move on. Like the noble warrior who doesn't want to fight, just all of these tropes that become, I mean, like, foundational aspects of future iterations of Trek. It just seemed like to have it thought out in this place. But I mean, of course, that's all based on like war movies, like this, like I said earlier with the like Hunt for Red October and that stuff. It's like this is based on other tropes just recontextualized into sci-fi. But yeah, to just to see it in place and working so well so early in the any kind of Trek at all was fascinating for me.
No, it's a really good point. And I think for me, it has to do with all the seeds that this episode really lays. I mean, it doesn't just mention Romulus. It also mentions Remus.
Yeah.
You know, it mentions both. And that follows all the way through till Star Trek Nemesis, which could be argued to be, you know, the end of the old way of Star Trek, you know, kind of signaling the end of that. It was almost full circle. This episode...
Oh, that's a bummer. That's true, isn't it? Nemesis is the last thing of that timeline.
I mean, more or less, you know. There's some wiggle room there, of course, if you want to really dig into it. But Nemesis, I mean, the tagline for Nemesis was, "A generation's final journey begins." You know, they knew that it was the end, and it comes full circle. It's Praetor Shinzon, which Praetor was the term used in Balance of Terror, and it's Romulus and Remus, and we get to see the Remans finally, and there's ships that are, you know, cloaked, and all of that. It's the Romulans that we see in Star Trek Nemesis are not that far removed from the ones that we see here in Balance of Terror.
True. And we also get young Tom Hardy.
We do get young Tom Hardy, yeah. But it goes to show that when Star Trek had strong episodes early on, people took note of that and looked back on them later and expanded on them. So Balance of Terror being one of the higher rated episodes, the second highest rated episode of season one of the original series, a lot of it was leveraged later on for more storytelling for Romulans.
Yeah. And I mean, it's, even though it was kind of like the silly helmets and the ship with a bird painted on it and all this kind of goofy stuff relative to the more serious iterations in Next Generation, it's still like, it's all there. It's like, it didn't feel foreign to me. It felt like ancestral, which it is.
Yeah. I think that's a great way to look at it. And even the uniforms had some of the same pattern or similar pattern designs that you would see in the later Romulan uniforms, which, you know, Romulans have always had a very distinct look that separates them from the other major species and civilizations that we see in Star Trek. And you can tell that there's a connection here. So it's cool. And if anything, this episode makes me a little sad because they talk about the Romulan War, which is what they had plans for in season 5 of Enterprise. If Enterprise had not been canceled, they had plans to begin the Romulan War. They had just started laying the seeds for that at the end of season 4. And so it would have been very interesting to see what brought about the neutral zone and the treaty that is on the verge of collapse here in Balance of Terror.
So was the Romulan War like World War II? Was it supposed to be like that scale? Or like, is there a World War II allegory in the Star Trek timeline?
The Romulan War was a big deal. So we still used atomic weapons. The ships were more advanced than Enterprise, but still nothing like what you see here in the original series. And the war was bad. I mean, the Federation and Starfleet was mainly exploration and scientific, even though some of that gets a little confused because of the Zindi arc and stuff in Enterprise. But either way, they were not prepared for an all-out war against a hostile force like the Romulan Empire. So the war doesn't go particularly well. It's a bad war. A lot of people die. And it basically caused Starfleet, Earth, to become a little isolationist. So it's a little bit more... It's very akin to World War One, where, you know, we became very isolationist after the war. And that happened. And essentially it took, you know, 40 years or so for Starfleet to kind of venture back out into the unknown.
Interesting. So we kind of, we spread our wings and then they kind of knocked us back.
Yeah. I mean, that's exactly what happened. We hit a wall, and not a wall like the Klingons. You know, the Klingons were different. But the Klingon War came later. The Klingon War was after the Romulan War.
So the end of Enterprise was basically the dawn of the Federation. So the Federation existed before the Romulan War?
Yes.
And it was like the Federation versus the Romulans, or did the Romulans have anyone else on their team?
There's not a whole lot of detail on the Romulan War, unfortunately, because it was never shown in canon. So it's a little hard to tell. I wouldn't be surprised if like the Orions or the Gorn were involved, but I don't know.
Okay. Asking too many questions.
No, it's good stuff. I wish we had been able to see it. There were some really amazing plans for season 5 of Enterprise that included the refit of the NX-01 to make it the SS Enterprise with a secondary hull and everything. It was beautiful. So it was some stuff I really wanted to see. But
maybe the Discovery will hit a time loop and they'll bring it out.
That would be cool. So before we close out, I put a couple polls out on Twitter just to kind of gauge some people, and 78% rated Balance of Terror as an A, with 0% as a D or lower, because you only get 4 options. And then for Mud's Women, it was mixed all over the place, but 42% gave it a C. That was the highest amount. 33% gave it a D or lower. So people did not really care for Mud's Women, and basically the exact opposite for Balance of Terror. People love this episode.
Well, that kind of goes with our little experiment here.
It does. Anything else you want to go over before we close out for the week?
No, I don't think so. Good episode and a bad episode. It's good to see the good one and disappointing to see the bad one.
Fair enough.
I imagine next week will be somewhat similar.
So next week we are covering Space Seed, the Khan episode, and Miri, which I actually don't think is as bad as the rating says. So hopefully you'll enjoy that one more. So join us next week for Space Seed and Miri, which I am excited to watch both of those again. We will be back, every Friday with a new episode. We're doing this new format right now, but we'll continue to change things up and do some different things here and there. So please stick with us. If you like what we're doing, or if you have any of your own comments, please let us know. We are Red Shirts and Runabouts on the Heroes Podcast Network. You can find us at heroespodcast.com and at Heroes Podcasts on Twitter and Facebook. The show is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Blog Talk Radio, and anywhere that you can really get your podcasts.
If you're Jeremy, hearing this, you know that.
Right. Yeah, probably. Jeremy, where can people find you?
I'm on Twitter at Zen Munkin, and I've got another podcast on the network called Analysis, a Westworld podcast. We are on episode 3 this week, or we will be on Sunday.
Fantastic. And I am the Star Trek Dude on Twitter and Facebook. I also co-host Screen Heroes and Gamer Heroes, 2 other shows on the Heroes Podcast Network, so feel free to check those out. Thank you so much for tuning in. We will be back, hopefully, with Greg next week to talk about Khan.
Khan!
Red Shirts and Runabouts is part of the Heroes Podcast Network. The show is hosted by myself, Gregory Bosco, along with Jeremy Munkin and Derek Mayer. The theme song is by Flying Killer Robots. You can find us, as well as other Heroes Podcast Network shows, at heroespodcast.com, as well as on iTunes, Blog Talk Radio, Google Play, and anywhere you can use an RSS feed. Follow us on social media at Heroes Podcast on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitch. And you can also email us at contact@heroespodcast.com. Engage.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.